brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Welcome to Soft Rev Radio. I'm your host today, Steve Balistrieri. Joining me is an old friend and a great guest, Stu Braden. He's the head of Global Soft Foundation. Stu and I are going to talk about a bunch of things that are affecting the force in 2020 and moving forward. But before we get going, we're going to welcome Stu to the podcast. Stu, thanks for taking the time today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Yay. You know, before we get started, we'll talk a little bit about, personal. Fill in our listeners about your, basic military career, because I know you had a pretty varied career and you served in a lot of different places.
Yeah, I did everything they told you not to do. So I'm an Army brat. I was born in 1961. My father went to Korea for 18 months, 5 days after I was born, which is probably a good thing, for all of us. But I grew up, my father was on active duty. When I came on active duty, I kind of started my military career. I was a cadet at the Citadel, and I was an enlisted man in the South Carolina National Guard. And I have an honorable discharge from the South Carolina National Guard. But I was a 19 Delta Cav Scout. When I came in 1984 on active duty, I was originally going to be a lawyer. And about 4 months prior to graduation, I walked in and said, I can't do it, man. I mean, everybody I was meeting was a lawyer, was a bum. The cool law was prosecuting criminals, and I just said I didn't want to do that anymore. So came in the Army as an armor officer. I wanted to go to the 11th Armored Cav Regiment, went to Bad Hersfeld, Germany. In order to have a scout platoon there, you had to go to ranger school. So I did ranger school and jump school and all the good stuff. At the 18-month mark, I applied to be an XO on a Special Forces ODA. I'd gotten the approval and everything, gotten orders, sending me to the Q course. And as soon as I got my orders in my hand, a moratorium or directive came down from DOD saying you couldn't move under your 3-year window. So basically those orders to the Q course were revoked. 18 months later, I resubmitted all my stuff. Special Forces was standing up as a branch at that time. I was in the first recruited class as an officer. In 1987, Captain Mark Phelan was my recruiting officer. I got through the Q course. I went to the Infantry Advanced Course, got through the Q course, went to 3rd of the 7th, where you and I served together. I was in 3-7 for, 26, 27 months. Went back to Fort Bragg. I was a foreign area officer for Latin America. I went to graduate school out of San Diego, language school for Portuguese. I served in Bolivia in the embassy. Again, we served down there together in the embassy. That was good times. Working for my crazy boss, Chip Shelverton. Yeah, good times. And I left there and went to a special mission unit in Virginia. Thought I was going to be doing stuff in Latin America. And when they got there, they said, hey, man, would you mind going to the Pacific? And I'm like, no, I'm your man. Put me in, coach. I'd never been to Hawaii, and they told me I would operate out of Hawaii and go to other places, and I just couldn't say yes fast enough. I was like, right on, man. I'm digging it. I left that unit because they had over-assessed officers, and so they said, look, everybody's not going to get a command, so you can't all stay here. Who wants to leave? And SF Brent says, we'll let you pick anywhere you want to go. And so I picked 1st Battalion, 10th Special Forces Group. At that time, it was 1995. Bosnia was kicking off. It seemed like there was going to be a gunfight of some nature in that area. Everything else was calm. So I figured, let's just go that direction. It seemed like a great place. I spoke Spanish, Portuguese, and German. Last time I looked, those languages all originated on the continent of Europe. So I felt overqualified and had a great time. I was the Battalion 3 and 1st Battalion for 20 months. I commanded Charlie 110 for 12, 13 months. I did everything in reverse. I went to work at SOC Europe for about 8 months because I was selected to go to School of America Staff College, the only school I asked not to go to, and that's the one they sent me to. I said, I'll go to anyone in the world, just don't send me to that one, and that's where I landed. I came out of there and was an instructor at Fort Leavenworth at the staff college I actually tried to get to. I did that for 3 years, and then while I was there, I got promoted to lieutenant colonel in the towers fell. And you're a lieutenant colonel. I was not on the command list. I kept coming up, you know, on the alternate list. I was honorable mention, as I would say. And, you know, you're trying to get into the fight and, you know, in any capacity. And so I was selected as what they call a GWAT augmentee. Originally, I was supposed to go to PACOM. And then at the last minute, they changed my orders to SOCUR. So I went back there. I was the deputy J3 of SOCUR for 3 years. You know, I work, I grind like a Ranger captain. So 18 hours a day is not a big deal for me. I was at an advanced auto parts store on Dale Mabry Boulevard right down here in Tampa, Florida. And I got a call from my boss, Mark Rosengard, another Bostonian. And he goes, "Hey, dude, you popped on the 06 list." I'm going, "What?" He goes, "You popped on the 06 list." I'm like, "There's no way." He goes, "I'm telling you, you're on the list." So I was buying brake hubs for an NCO at SOCUR, loaded them all up, flew back that evening. The next day I got back in, I went into the J1's office and the dude looked at me and I said, "Show me my sequence number." And that's when I realized, holy shit, I'm going to be a colonel. I was ready to get out. Everything I'd been doing was preparing me to get out of the military. You know, I was like, wow, okay. This changes things a little bit. The retirement pay from a colonel, a lieutenant colonel is pretty good. I was working in SOCUR and they said, "Hey, these are three places you could go, pick one." General Jones, the Marine at SOCUR, did a by name request for me to come up there and stand up the NATO soft headquarters. You know, I thought you could negotiate with your personnel officer. So I call up the dude and I was like, "Hey man, I like Belgium, but I wanted to replace Rosengard as the three here. Can I move from deputy?" He goes, "No, nah, man, listen, you got a by name request. General Jones has the highest date of rank of any 4-star in the Army, in the military, to include the chairman. So unless the Secretary of Defense intervenes on your behalf," and he goes, "and that's probably not going to happen, you're going to Belgium." I was like, "All right, we're going to Belgium. Great." And so I served there. I went there on a 2-year tour, came out five years, standing up the NATO soft headquarters. I didn't even go to the same college for 4 years. It's the longest I'd ever lived anywhere in my life. We left there. And I'd been working with Bill McCraven, how a Navy SEAL and an SF dude got partnered is, I can't explain it to you. We've had some very interesting times. You know, we've done things that you probably, you know, I shouldn't share, but you know, it's good. I mean, he's a normal dude. He's a redneck. He'll get in a bar fight in a heartbeat. I mean, with a drop of a hat, he'll get into a fight. And so if you let him, and so when I got ready to leave Belgium, he says, "Hey, do you want to come back to Tampa?" And my intent was, I would tell everybody, "I'm going to get off the plane with in-processing paperwork in one hand and retirement paperwork in the other, and don't ask me to do anything hard because I'll probably drop it." But I agreed to work for him for 3 years at SOCOM, and I did. And I retired out of SOCOM in 2014 with 32 years.
And that's how you got into the global soft, because wasn't it Admiral McRaven that kind of convinced you to go that route?
Well, we had a thing called the Global Soft Network we were building. The intent was we wanted to institutionalize everything we were doing at SOCOM, right? And there's a thing called .MIL-PF, right? So if you want to, and you have to go through the JSIDS process. And so you take your idea forward and all the services and everybody votes on it. And once it's approved by the force, it's implemented into everyone's doctrine, joint doctrine, Army, Navy, Marine Corps. It becomes part of the common lexicon of the military. A lot of people are lazy, and it's a shitty process, man. It's hard to do. It's not, you know, it can be done. We did it in like 9 months. We actually had a great Marine 1-star up at the Pentagon who walked this thing through because he was a big believer in it. And he had been me at one point struggling to do something like this. And so we got it through, and I had a team of about 90 folks. And we had different pieces and parts. One of them handled the Admiral's engagement piece, right? So he would go up to D.C. and he would engage with all the think tank folks. And what we'd do is we'd have a 4-hour closed session in a room where he would talk. I mean, people dropping the F-bomb. It was full contact. And people that you see on all the Sunday talk shows. And the intent was is for him to socialize his ideas and, I mean, truly kick them around. I mean, people he learned a lot. He changed a lot. You know, it kind of helped us, you know, reformulate some of the things we were doing. It also, it told us when we were right and where we should go forward. A lot of times we weren't going as fast as people thought we should in certain areas, which was interesting. And but this I had about team of 5 or 6 people that managed that. We do that every quarter. And that was it also allowed him to build a network of human beings in DC that could help him spread his message, right? If it's just one guy behind a podium and he's just lecturing people, you don't survive. So, you know, that's even Jesus had disciples, right? And so you get people out, you build a network, and you get people to be your, you know, your agents of change. And so that's what we did. But one of the things the group does is they do big events, and they helped with the International Soft Week that's a part of SOFIC. And 1 year we didn't have it, and we had the GEOINT down here, and Adam McCraven told me to help them form GEOINT. The guy by the name of Keith Mosbach was the president of the U.S. Geospatial Intelligence Foundation. Looked at me one day in the eye and says, how come SOF doesn't have a professional association? And I don't know, man, I'm working 15-hour days, 6 days a week. I'm not looking for a hobby. Honestly, God, I didn't even know what a 501c3 was. I mean, I've seen it before. I'm like, okay, great, whatever. I didn't know what a nonprofit did. I mean, I thought you didn't get any money. I mean, I didn't know anything. I know nothing about it. And he kept telling me, you should form one. So over 8 months, we're working with them to institutionalize this big event in Tampa and bring the soft community into it. And he goes, I'll help you form one for the soft community because they need one desperately. And, you know, when you and I came in the mid-80s, man, you know, the whole community wasn't 10,000 people.
Right. Yeah.
75,000 people. And when you add in the contractors, which, you know, we probably it's another 30,000 on top of that minimum, at least 30,000, probably more. And then when you add in what I call all the direct support folks, you know, from other agencies like NGA and DIA and all these other places and stuff. I mean, you're talking anywhere from 100 to 120,000 people probably spread out across the entire enterprise. So it's a big enterprise, man. It's not small. And they're everywhere. They're just literally all over the globe. And so, you know, it made sense to do it. I had no idea how to do it. I started reading the bylaws, you know, that's like your governing documents. And what I really liked about the U.S. Geospatial Intelligence, it was run by members and partners. It didn't have like a bunch of retired generals and sergeant majors sitting up there in a benevolent manner, acting like they were on active duty, telling everybody what to do. I mean, it was truly collaborative and collegial. And I said, this is pretty cool, man, because the people that are in it actually get to decide what it does and doesn't do. So I was digging that. And so we formed ours to be in the same manner. We started in 2014. Here we are. We started our 7th year this year. We've got 2,600 plus people from 62 countries. About 65% of the people are active duty. It's free for active duty. I'll come back to that in a minute. And we've got corporate partners. We have, I think it's 92 or 94 corporate partners. They range everything from massive companies to small businesses that are, you know, veterans, disabled owned and stuff. And so we do events all over the place. And so, you know, what we do is we
can. I know it's hard to catch up with you. I mean, you're always traveling someplace. I obviously right now, you know, with the COVID and coronavirus that's going on, you haven't been traveling as much, but it's tough to keep up with which country you're in. I usually talk to your wife more than I talk to you.
Yeah. I will tell you the first 3 years were horrible because I would be in the Middle East. I would fly back through Europe. Then I would come to Tampa. I would turn around and like 2 days later, fly back to Europe. And then I would get back from Europe and I would fly to like Asia, you know, back to Japan or Korea somewhere. And it would just, I mean, I'm 58 years old and you feel that stuff. You know, when you're 30 and 35, you got it, man. You're like, holy crap, you know. But let me tell you, man, when you hit like 58, man, I mean, the recovery time ain't there, man. You don't need someone to tell you you're old. That just, you know, reinforces the whole thing. But it was tough. We were small. You know, we stayed real small. We only have 7 full-time employees, counting myself. Our tent's never to be big. We're a networked organization. We're a network of networks. And so we leverage the people that are in the network. And we just ask them for free. Like, hey, man, would you do the following? Yes or no? If the answer is no, then we just move on. Find somebody that says yes. Get to yes quickly. And so, or get to know quickly. And so that's what we're trying to do. But, you know, it's like being a case officer. I manage a network of networks. We support our industry partners. We're trying to bring, you know, capability to our international partners. We've had huge success. I helped write the legislation to stand up the joint soft headquarters in the Ukraine. I've advised the Japanese government on doing it, the Jordanian. I mean, we just, we're all over the place. We really focus on joint soft headquarters, so we have one single point of entry for the country. But I spend a lot of time talking to parliamentarians and stuff. And in the U.S., it's on Congress. I think since COVID started, I do 4 or 5 calls or VTCs a week with some senator staffer, congressional staffer up there, supporting, you know, special ops issues. Good stuff. I mean, I enjoy it. I'm punching way above my league. But, you know, when you manage a network, it's not me, right? So I'll bring in 15 or 20 other people that are far smarter and better looking than I am.
For a guy who was an operator, this is a big change for you, because I'm going to share with our listeners the first time we met, which I'll always remember, because I just got to 3-7 down in Panama as a warrant. I just graduated the warrant course. This was like more than 30 years ago, like late 89. And Louis Zayas, who was the commo guy on our team, I signed into the company. You were out in the interior in Panama. And they said, you're going to Captain Braden's team. And then all the guys in the company, oh, Jesus. You know, well, wait till you meet him. And then out there, Louis was filling me in. And Louis's like, Captain B's all about being an action dude. So if you want to make your bones with him, just say, hey, you know, I want to be an action guy. So I said, okay. So Major Higgins, Kevin Higgins, is a great officer. Kevin Higgins was our company commander, and he drove me out there. Me, Kevin, Louis Zayas, we met you in a little Panamanian dump restaurant. It was, like, really tiny. You come walking in, no shirt. All you had was an Army T-shirt. You had the Ray-Bans with the green string, shoulder rig, and you're like, hey, dude, are we going to face shoot somebody or not? And I was like, I looked over at Louis. Louis had a big smile on his face, and I was like, I think – I always hearken back to that moment, like the Humphrey Bogart moment in Casablanca. I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Yeah. That was like 30 years ago, and here we are today.
We just come out of Peru with another team, right as Just Cause was getting ready to go. And half my team was in Peru, and we were supposed to be on, you know, like block leave. We couldn't leave country, but we were in country and stuff. And you know, half of them were liquored up at Black's Beach, and you know, I had to go find them all. They're spread out everywhere. You know, yeah, it was a good different times. You know, I don't think, just great leadership. I mean, great battalion. You know, one of the greatest experiences of my life was being in that battalion. Phenomenal senior NCOs and officers came out of that. You know,
3-7 at that time. I mean, you look back. Charlie Cleveland was the 3. Hector Pagan was the adjutant. I mean, both of those guys made general officers.
I mean, there's a ton of, you know, it was a really, I mean, you know, senior NCOs, man. I mean, guys, I can't tell you how many sergeant majors came out of that. But dudes went down there, you know, because that's where, you know, if you wanted to go to war, you went there. So yeah. it was good times.
So moving on to Global Soft, going back there, I mean, look, hearkening back to those times, I mean, the time that we spent together, it was about 2 years that you were on the team while I was there. And those were the most fun times I had in the military. I'll think back of that. We had a great team. We had a really awesome group of NCOs. I used to look forward to going to work every day. So.
Yeah. I'm in a different world now. Totally different
yeah. world now. Yeah. And I'm older than you, so I know what you're talking about when you said you don't need somebody reminding you when you feel old.
Yeah.
So with Global Soft, I know that there's a couple of things that you're really passionate about, and we talked offline about one of them the other day. Fill in our readers, listeners, I should say, not our readers, but a lot of our readers are listeners as well. Fill them in on what the force needs, and I know what number one need is going forward, 2020 and beyond, when we're talking about the undersecretary.
Let me back up a minute, right? So this is showing you how stupid I am, right? So I had never been to when I was a colonel, they let me go to Congress, right? Which I didn't know that you weren't supposed to do that as a colonel. You were like supposed to have handlers, and you know, you could only move your mouth a certain way. You had to like read a script card. And so General Craddock and General Jones just let me roll in there and be me. And that was not probably the smartest thing those 4 stars ever did. But the staffers appreciate it, right? You just cut to the bullshit. Tell me what I got. You know, they're like, hey, dude, I got a lot of work to do. So just tell me what the answer to the test is. That's all I want to know. And most people are afraid to tell them, hey, dude, just do this right here and call it a day. So I learned this and stuff. And so in 2015, we were up on Capitol Hill with Adam Smith and Mac Thornberry in the House Armed Services Committee. And one of them says, hey, dude, would you do a platform document for special ops needs for U.S. special ops? And my response was, nobody reads that shit anyway, you know. And he goes, oh, yeah, they do. He said, every congressional rep and every senator has a military legislative affairs person. And they read the National Defense Authorization Act, which is like two New York phone books. That same staffer who's 22 to 26 years old also reads the Military Intelligence Program, which is, you know, two more phone books of the New York. So they're huge. And they've got to know what every line means, what it, you know, why it's important, and then how it fits certain things. So by producing this platform document, we really simplify it down to no shit. Here's what the special ops community needs. For us, I can't just sit here and make stuff up, you know, and say, this is what Stu thinks. And so what we did is we said, hey, look, we have a network, we have, and we can't speak on behalf of US SOCOM, but we sure as heck can, we can send out a survey to our partners and our members and stuff. And we can say, hey, here's what we're hearing. Here's what's out there. And then the last thing on the survey is anything else you want us to go after, right? And so we send the survey out. We usually have good results from it, you know, and since, you know, over half the people are active duty, we get a lot of good stuff. We get a lot of things that Congress can't legislate, like they can't fix your leadership. Congress can't give the Army good leadership. They can't, no law in the world will make that happen. But there's a lot of things that Congress can fix, and so we focus on them. And we refined it. And up to this point, you know, we had this beautiful brochure. We would go to distribution time. And my personal network and the network of the foundation pretty much ended there. We weren't lobbyists. We didn't have a Capitol Hill background. We didn't do it. So we partnered with Phil Anderson and the Navigators Global team. They've got Lieutenant General retired Tom Trask, the former vice commander of SOCOM, Lieutenant General retired John Mulholland. They've got Colonel retired Mark Mitchell, former 5th Group commander, DSC winner, former acting ASD Solik, and they formed a national security team. So I was like, okay, these dudes know the community. They have their stuff together. You know, they can help us. This company and this partner can help us. And so this year we create what we call the soft imperatives document, right? And its results are from the survey and it goes out to Capitol Hill. This year, our two big things are, we are trying to elevate the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low Intensity Conflict to an undersecretary. And everybody goes, oh, that's just a bunch of policy crap. Look, special ops can't do its job because it never gets authority to do shit. Been that way forever. We swim upstream like salmon, and the grizzlies are just mauling the whole way up the stream. And the only way that's ever going to change is someone from the special ops community is in a high enough position to be in the room when the decisions are made. Now, in 1987, when the Cohen-Nunn Amendment came out, they formed SOCOM and they formed SOLIC. There weren't that many assistant secretaries of defense. So that guy was a powerful dude. He had a lot of influence. But over time, there's like 17 or 19 ASDs now. I mean, you got like a platoon of them. You could defend a hill in Korea against a Chinese assault with all of them. There's too many. And so they're not invited into the room for the senior decision. So what's happening is the soft response or a soft course of action is never considered. It's a missile strike, send a carrier task force, or do nothing. And so in order to change the narrative, we've got to put someone in the room that's at a high enough level that they can ensure that we get the authorities we need to do our jobs. That's that simple. Everybody goes, oh, that's all political bullshit. Yeah, it sure is, man. You want somebody who's has got enough juice to be in the room when the president makes the decision, say, boss, that's the wrong thing to do. And the undersecretary is the right level. I'm surprised they didn't do that. You know, SOCOM has service-like, you know, SOLIC has service-like responsibility. So in 2017, in the National Defense Authorization Act, Congress changed everything. And they subordinated U.S. SOCOM to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low Intensity Conflict, ASD SOLIC, for all things non-operational. So for manpower, funding, procurement, all that stuff, they report to SOLIC. A lot of people don't like that. That's the law. It's been the law since 2017. The Department of Defense didn't do anything. They sat on that and they didn't do anything. So in 2018, Defense Authorization Act, Congress said a thing, said, hey, get off your butt, start moving. We want to report. Nothing. 2019, same thing. 2020, same thing. So we've sent three warnings already. And so since 2016, we have been advocating that just elevate the person to an undersecretary position, take them out from under USD policy. They did all this in 2017. Solik now works directly for Assistant Secretary of Defense. He doesn't work for an undersecretary. So he should therefore be designated as an undersecretary. Anyway, for us in the soft community, if you're a dude on a team, let me tell you what this means to you. This means that the special ops course of action that you sit around going, I don't understand why these jackasses don't let us do our jobs, that could change overnight. The other thing is, I engage a lot of people on Capitol Hill. And, you know, they all like to throw out the buzzwords, right? They go, hey, you know, great power competition, but, you know. And so the first question I ask them is, have you guys ever read Chinese and Russian doctrine? It's not very long. It's like 20, 30 pages. That's it. Have you ever read it? And the answer is no. And I said, well, let me help you out. I'm gonna give you the Reader's Digest version. Both of those countries, and you would say Iran as well, have built their doctrine on avoiding a conventional fight. They want to fight this in the shadows. They want to use special ops. They want to use intelligence. They want to use espionage. They want to use cyber information ops. But they want to win the fight before the conventional force can deploy en masse.
Sun Tzu, baby.
But, and this is what, and they actually follow their doctrine, unlike the United States.
Unlike us.
Yeah, we kind of, it's out there, it's good paper, but we don't really do it. And so that's what they're marching to, and we're continuing to crank out aircraft carriers and joint strike fighters. This is the first year, Steve, in over 24 years that I can go back, that the soft budget is being cut. And you don't hear boo. And this is pre-corona, right? This has got nothing to do with corona. So next year when they go to do the budget build and the bills for corona start coming in, you think the cuts this year hurt? It's going to cut deep. And there is nobody but the Global Soft Foundation up there advocating. Our big deal is you have spent a phenomenal amount of time, blood, and energy to build a capable force. Do not tear it down. Do not let it go backwards. If you truly believe China and Russia are the threats in the great power competition and Iran, then the one force that you're going to need the most is the Special Ops Force. You're going to need them more than you ever had. Now, here's a force that doesn't even have a 2-to-1 bogged well. It's over-deployed. It is coming apart at the seams. And the tool they need is that tool. And you can't produce more. It ain't going to happen. This is why we focus on our international partners. We have got to get them up to speed quickly. We've got to make them near peer or peers as quickly as we can, because we don't have the gene pool or the wherewithal to produce the people. We've got to get them in the game. So we want the undersecretary elevated.
Now, and speaking of our global partners, how is that going with the Global Soft Network in terms of, you know, how are our allies, are the people that we work with, how are those countries progressing?
Good. So, you know, I mean, every country that I honestly thought would never have joint soft special operations now have them. There's been good studies and, you know, work and looking at them and stuff. And the key now is the capability, right? So I will tell you, at the tactical operator dude level, they're as good as we are. Almost every single interview loves bullshit, you know. There, it's the same. I mean, they say rocket science, man. Where they can't keep up with us is they don't have the cross training that we have. So we have a little bit more depth in cross training. That's coming. And then the command and control and the ISR integration, you know, the Intel integration piece. Like, you know, we have air. Most of these guys don't. So they have to go and partner with their Air Force element or their Army element, who it's not a habitual relationship with. And so they struggle. You know what I mean? And so the big push now, I would just say, especially the NATO side of the house, is to get soft aviation built up. Because they show up at all these fights and they got no aircraft. So they want to mooch on ours. Well, we don't have enough for our own people. And so, you know, we spend a lot of time bringing in conventional air to fly, you know, things they probably shouldn't be flying. And it just increases the risk factor, but it's going really, really well. Some of them have quadrupled in size over 10 years. Lithuania has got a separate service. So they've got the air, the land, maritime, and special ops. Those are the four services. They've all been elevated up. They're flattening their chains of command, you know, so they work for the chief of defense and the minister of defense, just, you know, in the same manner. So it allows them to be more aggressive. Some of them are, you know, slower than others. It's all about money and programmatics and timing of stuff. And you have to convince politicians and parliamentarians that used to be socialist and communist that they've got to move away from that configuration. Most of your former Soviet bloc or Eastern European folks are transitioning out of the Soviet capabilities. You know, we brought them into NATO and they all had AK-47s and, you know, everything that was Soviet. Well, none of that matches the NATO standard. You know, and NATO was going to say, well, we'll just declare it to be the standard, too. We can't have 50 standards and call it a standard. You know, I mean, just pick one. And so they're divesting themselves of all that Russian stuff that, you know, they had and stuff. And so they want to be aligned with the West, you know. And so that's a good thing. But it's money, you know, but they're doing it. You know, they're all building it out. They go to our schools. You know, if you go down range and you look at these dudes, like, I mean, I was watching a bunch of Romanian special ops dudes and they're listening to rap music and I'm hearing the dudes say F this and F that. And I'm thinking, oh, we have ruined these people, man. They're as screwed up as we are now, you know. I mean, they just, you know, they look, and at night when you're on nods, you can't tell those dudes from our dudes, man. Just, you know, just the whole mannerisms and, you know, the, hey, screw them. And you're just like, oh, Jesus, man, we have completely ruined these people. So, but it's good. You know, they're learning, they're accepted. And, you know, what's happening is because of the deployments a lot, I mean, everybody knows everybody. I mean, we've known each other for 20, 30 years. And so, I mean, and we know everybody's strengths and weaknesses. Sometimes they have authorities that we'll never get. And they can do stuff that we would never be authorized to do. And that works well for us. Sometimes they aren't authorized to do it, right? Just their government says, hey, I can't legally do that. But there are times when it works in our favor. You know, the U.S. has a lot of restrictions as well, you know. So you just have to, you know, work with what you've got. That's come along. The other piece I wanted to talk about is in our soft imperatives, we're pushing for armed overwatch this year. So armed overwatch is something that goes back to when you and I joined. They used to have the old twin engine jet dragonfly things, you know, as the close air support, you know, it could go to austere places. When you and I were in Bolivia, we had the PC-12s, I think, or PC-7s. Mm-hmm. And those are the Platus, you know, single engine things, which are, and they were phenomenal. I mean, we crashed that one, as you remember, we went and did fire recovery on that, but they're phenomenal. You know, after you and I left, they used them to shoot down drug planes with them all the time. I mean, they were doing like 60, 70 a week. And so it was good, you know, and so that's some serious shooting down. AFSOC has got a proposal, you know, that's going in right now. It's the SOCOM number one proposal to do what they call armed overwatch because they want it to have sensors. They want it to do a lot for them. It's designed to replace the 40 U-28s that are currently in the system. You know, U-28's a unique bird. It's got 9 radios on it. It controls the stack for us. So when you're up there, it's not, we don't deal with the AWACS, the U-28 guys are handling the stack, you know, and so it's really cool. It's special ops. It's what you want. You want one of us doing it. They have ownership. They land and live with you on the base, you know, so it's not like, you know, they're some dude who lives in a distant, you know, land. And I mean, he sleeps at the same place you do. You know what I'm saying? So they're going to replace those platforms because they're on the fourth life cycle to replace them. So the hours on those planes are ridiculous, the U-28s. But they're going to add new capability to it. And what it'll do is AFSOC's number one thing is focusing on being able to operate in an austere environment. So I believe to this day that if we had these in Niger, those kids would still be alive. I'm 100% certain. Just the ISR platforms alone would have alerted the teams way ahead of the ambush. You know, the bird could have connected on fires as well, but just the early warning. I mean, I think that team, if they'd have known ahead of time, they could have put the boot to them and they would have been different, much different. I'm not saying everybody would have survived, but I just don't think with the loss of life would have been anywhere close to what it was and the injuries and stuff. And so it's going to give the special ops community a capability to have a very small footprint where you have manned ISR and a kinetic strike capability in a very small package. Folds up, fits in the back of a C-130,
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because when you're talking ISR capability, I know, and especially with our partner forces, that's one of the problems the French are having in the Sahel. They're asking for our help, because I guess a lot of the ISR comes from our birds. They don't have enough of it. Is there going to be enough for us to share with our partners?
Great question. So when I was in Afghanistan, the French Special Forces had Rover 5s, you know, made by L3, the same thing our operators had. But their birds, their platforms, they could not send through a Rover 5. So they had to use our birds to receive any feeds from their ISR. Me personally, right now the French have a task force, a Special Forces task force in there, 4,500. Next month in July, they're going to put another 4,500-man task force in there that's going to focus mainly on mentoring. One is kinetic, like you saw, they killed the head AQ guy.
Yeah.
Now they're going to focus a 4,500 just on training and mentoring. But we've lost Africa. Like, Burkina Faso is almost completely overrun. The government refused to allow anybody to help them. They finally opened their doors to support 3 weeks ago. I mean, you know, when you've lost 75% of your terrain, that's not easy to go and get back. And so, and this is not, you know, all these tankers, and it's a special ops environment. It's what, that's who's going to go. And it's pretty damn austere out there. But we're struggling now. And we're seeing ISIS and Al-Qaeda move down through Central Africa and heading into Southern Africa. And so it's creating a dilemma. Then you mix in that the Russian mercenaries from the Wagner group are there, and the Chinese are doing the support to the African Union forces. I mean, it's like Kelly's Heroes, you know. You've got the dope smoking tankers, the AWOL infantry dudes. You got banned Graves registration dudes. It's out of control. You got just crazy mix of, and it's just, there's a UN mission. There's an African Union mission. There's national missions. There's a NATO mission. It's just.
And then a G5 Sahel mission.
Yep. And everybody's running around going, what the hell is going on? And so it's a real mess. And frankly, nobody has stepped up and said, look, we're going to sort this. I think from a U.S. perspective, we ought to be in the support role. And if giving them ISR is all we can do, we should do it. We have the bases in Agadez, and, you know, we might as well. They're not going anywhere. We might as well fly it. You know, if the French want to kill them, that's beautiful. Go do that, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. But fill us in on some of the other imperatives that you brought up this year.
You know, the other, there's a bunch of them on there. Those are the, you know, the armed overwatch and the under secretary are too big. We're working with 7th Special Forces Group to get a child development center put on the base down there. You know, when 7th Group was BRAC'd out of Fort Bragg, right, you know, the DOD moves them down there, right? Beautiful facilities, everything. They decided to put the child development center on the middle of Eglin. So for anybody that's never been to Eglin, it's still one of the largest military installations in the U.S. It's massive. The 7th Group is up north, and up near I-10 in Crestview. Well, to get down to Big Eglin proper, Maine, can be an over an hour drive on 2-lane roads. So if you're a spouse and you're trying to work and you got to drive an hour one way, hour plus sometimes one way, to drop your kids off, to then to go to work and then pick them up, it's the amount of drama and stress it's putting on the wives and the spouses is ridiculous.
We all know what happens when they're under stress, right?
I mean, I was told they are people getting divorces because the family doesn't have enough money to survive. They're all junior enlisted, right? And so no disrespect to the Air Force, but, you know, they're pilots, man. And so they all get flight pay. They're getting over $800 flight pay. So they're all living out on the beach, right? Closer to Eglin, closer to the amenities and everything. All the junior enlisted are living up north, right? Because he can't afford to live on the freaking. And so the people that need child care is not some guy whose first name is Major or Lieutenant Colonel. It's some guy who's a sergeant, right? He needs the child care so his wife can work so they can freaking pay their bills. And so we're busting ass to get $15 million for this thing. And of course, you've got an Army unit on an Air Force installation. So it's just, you know, it's a complete shit show trying to get this done. I don't know how successful we'll be this year, but we've got it's moving forward. The Corps of Engineers is funding the thing. You know, if we don't get it this year, I feel pretty darn good we're going to get it next year. They've got to do what's called a charrette and do the design and scope it out. And, you know, they'll do all the surveys of the land And then it's just really about funding it. And then, you know, they'll contract it. The contractors will hit the ground, and it's, you know, however long it takes them to slap one of those bad boys together. You know, but there's 168 families on a waiting list down there. It's 440 some kids. I mean, everybody's learned in COVID, man. If you can't get your kids out of your house and get them, it's not good, man. Somebody's gonna start killing kids, man. Because that's just too much children too often. You know, you can't be with your kids that much. You know, that's why we have teachers and stuff. You know, they know how to handle those and educate them. You know, but if you leave them with the parents for that long, it's not good, man. I mean, it's just, they can't entertain them and work. You know, I mean, it's just not, it's not fair to ask them to do that. So we're focusing on a bunch of those things. The big thing is right now is that there's these deterrence issues, you know, like, so in UConn, they have, everybody remembers Obama's speech, you know, about the $5 billion for UConn, and everybody loved the idea. They were pissed at Obama because he just threw it out on the table, very Trump-like, just chucked it on the wire and said, there you go, boys and girls. Everybody freaked out. He didn't consult with them. At the end of the day, now it's $5.99 billion and stuff. And so what we're doing is we're running around and we're asking hard questions. Like SOCUR gets $85 million out of that this year. That's 1.44% of the $5.99 billion. Really? That's it for irregular warfare. That's beautiful. 1.44%. That's their contribution. Other, it's really going to all the big Army, big Navy, big Air Force, you know, stuff. They're just, you know, using that to train and do stuff with. And so we're trying to ask hard questions like, you know, why is irregular warfare and special operations not, you know, getting more resources to do the things they need to do? They're doing the same thing. There's a $43 billion bill going out from PACOM. Everybody sees Tom Cotton as the guy. There's Democrats and Republicans. It's bipartisan. You know, and they want to change some of the logistics footprint in PACOM. But, you know, one of the big, you know, the biggest thing we're getting our ass beat with on the Chinese is the information operations. And there's nothing in this that fixes any of that. And so we're going to spend a whole ton of money building boat docks at Cameron Bay, and, you know, for ships that are going to sink well before they ever get to, you know, a coastal region. And we're going into Congress and we're educating on, you know, allocating money to special operations so we can fund some of these missions so we can get our teams and our folks out there, you know, doing the things they're supposed to be doing. Marco Rubio is doing one for $500 million for Latin America. It's good stuff. It allows the units to deploy on something other than traditional exercise-related funding. You know, the authorities with exercises are horrible. You can basically show up and train, which is not totally worthless, but it's very limiting if you're trying to deal with an adversary, right? If you're using that to confront an adversary, it's just weakness. Those are some of the big ones I can think of off the top. I spend most of my time focusing on the big stuff. I think if you get the big stuff right, you know, the policy stuff right, everything else sorts itself out. And so that's, we push that. The other big thing I spend a lot of time on is transitioning. You know, I don't know if we run what's called a Soft for Life program. Well, before I go on, I'll just tell you this. We are looking for people to join as individual members, right? It's $25 a year, $50 for 3 years. You can be a lifetime member, and it's free for active duty. Now, when I was in the Army, you know, they always had the first arm would come out there with the, you know, they beat up the NCOs about NCOA. I mean, I used to hit an AUSA. I got an OER withheld when I was in the CAV because I didn't renew my AUSA thing. Well, I've been on the border for like 120 days, you know, not a lot of post offices up there. You know what I'm saying? And so the guy was actually holding back my OER, which would have hurt me. You know, I might not have gotten promoted. Right. And I'm like, dude, are you kidding me? So I vowed never. I didn't want the Global Soft Foundation to be that kind of professional association. And so I said, hey, man, active duty is free, man. You know, don't pay anything. Why? You know, we don't make money off it. I have this very expensive system that, you know, any of the money goes into that to run. But it's built for professional associations, unlike any other association. You get a password, you go in, you can set up your profile. We got a thing called Breezio coming out here in about 3 or 4 months. So once you log in, it'll be like its own internal LinkedIn. You can set up communities of interest. You guys can, everybody can communicate. You can type in a country and it'll show you who's in the country. You discern how much of your information you disclose, right? It's all password protected. People ask me all the time, is it safe? It's as safe as your bank account. It uses the same encryption protocols is your bank account. So if you're comfortable with your money, you should be comfortable with this. But it's really important to get individual members to join, right? And then the main thing is when we send out the surveys, man, getting their input. You know, if you don't say shit, I tell people, if you do nothing, nothing will happen. You know, and so if you take the surveys, you tell us what's going on, do everything we can to help and fix it. And so, and again, when I say we is the collective network. But the other thing we do is we run what's called the Soft for Life program. And the Soft for Life program is three nonprofits. It's the Global Soft Foundation, the Honor Foundation, and AFMA. We manage the program. We manage the databases of resumes. We push out resumes. The Honor Foundation runs a world-class transition course that's like 120 hours. They have a fixed campus in San Diego, Little Creek, and down at Stone Bay near the MARSOC. We have a virtual one as well. We're working hard to build one at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and all the other major commanders. They're expensive as hell to do. You know, I would say between $600,000 and $2 million to put a campus out there. They're not cheap. Believe me, when you don't know all these numbers and you see them when you start doing it, you're just like, holy crap, this is not cheap. It costs about $10,000 a student to go through the course is what it runs. So, you know, there's a lot of fundraising that goes on to do it. But it sets them up for success getting out. AFMA is the oldest nonprofit in the country. It actually was formed during the Civil War because there was no benevolent organization. There was no, you know, if you got killed, they buried you where you fell. You know, your wife, family, ain't getting nothing, man. And it really came to pass at Little Bighorn when the 7th Cav lost two entire squadrons, just wiped off the map. You had all these families sitting on these forts spread out all over the Midwest that they had to be, like, recovered. You know, what are they going to do? And so the Army formed the Army Mutual Aid Association. Then it became the Army Air Force. Then it became now it's the Armed Forces Mutual Aid Association. They're headquartered on Fort Myers. And they do a lot of financial advising. You know, they tell people, hey, this is what you got to do. This is what you can't do. These are your benefits. Like, you know, if you get injured or hurt at any time, you know, they're very smart on making sure that you get the benefits that the nation owes you. They're really, really good at that. So, and they answer questions that, you know, they don't sell anything. They'll tell you, hey, these are the ones we recommend. Pick from the menu. We don't care. So we form that. And it's really focused because there's a lot of soft charities out there. There's hundreds of them with an S, multiple. So a lot of them do great stuff. A lot of them are teeny tiny. But there's not many out there that focus on transition. So if you're not dead or seriously injured, a lot of them don't apply to the 98% of the people that just serve. You know, they're busted up, banged up, and they just get out. You know, people like us, right? And what most people in our community want to do is, hey, man, they just want a job. They want to do, you know, go do something interesting, and they want a new mission in their life. They want to move on. And they want to take care of their families, man. You know, they're not looking for handouts or, you know, they don't want anybody to feel sorry for them. I mean, these dudes just want to get on after it, right, and do something different. And so we've designed what we call Soft for Life. We think this program helps, you know, our people. And when I say so, it's not just the operator. I tell people all the time, if you're in the community, I don't care if you're a truck driver or a bottle washer. I mean, you know, once you get an S identifier and you've been in the community, you're ruined. You're never going to go back to the conventional force. You get fired. You get thrown out. And so we take care of all the folks in our formations and stuff. And it's pretty huge. I'm a big proponent of it. We run these one-day seminars. We've done certain things to educate the force on it. They're doing really good. The average salary is almost $140,000 a year, and that's officer NCO. But they spend a lot of time up front in the course focused on the why, and they try to get people to figure out what the heck it is they want to do with their lives once they get out. You know, a lot of people focus on money and resumes. That's all bullshit, man. Once you know what it is you're passionate about, what you're good at, and what you really want to do, then they tailor everything to getting you in that area. You know, no sense in writing a resume for some corporate headquarters that you have no desire to be in because you won't last and stuff. So we spend a lot of our energy and efforts trying to help people transition out, because whether you do 40 years or 4 years, man, at some point in time, everybody transitions.
That's it. I wish that was around when I got out.
You know? I'll tell you. I've been out to San Diego several times. I went out to, you know, I went to grad school out there, and it was I've been to Stone Bay, and I've been to Virginia Beach, and I'm really excited about getting one at Fort Bragg. And the reason is because it's like five times the population of those other three campuses combined. You know, they think over 450 special ops people transition out of Fort Bragg every year. That's an infantry battalion.
That's every year. That's a lot of folks.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of them wander out and, you know, some of them are great self-starters and stuff. You know, when I first, we do a survey, we did a software life survey. So when I first got out, I've been out, you know, almost 7 years now. And, you know, everybody goes, hey, sir, I want to talk to you about transitioning, getting out and everything. You know, I love our people, man. They're all self-assured, cocky, you know. I mean, this is what we select in success. You know, we want this, right? We want that person that goes until the last drop of blood pumps through their heart. And they all got a plan. You know, I got this plan. I'm going to do it. And I listened to them. And when I first started doing it, I listened to them and I was like, that's bullshit. I just cut them off. I was like, hey, dude, that's not how it works. And my wife kind of tightened me up on that. She says, hey, look, man, you don't cut them off, you know, because you just like, it's like crush them. You know, I can see it in their face when you just cut them off and say that's bullshit. So I learned now. I'm this is the new refined Steve Braden. I let them pick out their plan. And I asked the first question to him, how long can you go unemployed? And usually dude can't answer you. He's got the stunned mullet look. His wife next to him, who is the COO of the operation, who pays all the bills, knows where everything is, all the stuff. She has shock and horror in her face because the tone and the way I ask the question, and she'll usually respond with, we probably have 3 to 6 months we could go unemployed. My second question is that savings and college fund, or is that just a discretionary money you've got set aside for unemployment? No, that's everything. Yep. So our survey found that most people are underemployed or unemployed 9 to 15 months. That ain't good, man.
No.
We're going to bring that down. We're going to bring that way down. Our goal is to attack that and crush that. And the only way you do it, I mean, I tell the NCOs, this is on you. I tell them, I was an NCO, I was an officer. I tell them both times I came in the Army, I was greeted by the same person. First name was Sergeant. Now, when you're a private, right, you know, they're not as nice to you as you, but as a lieutenant, they're only marginally nicer. They'll throw in a sir, or they'll do the Ricky Bobby thing with all due respect, you know, but they still treat you like shit, right? But when you come in, you have sergeants, man. They there, they get you in the force, they get you trained, they get you equipped, and they get you in the fighting force. That's their job, unmatched in doing it. And when you go to get out, sergeant ain't there. They give you a checklist, and you thought, you're just like you were leaving post, man, like you're PCS, and you go down the checklist, you go to your tap, you go see this dude, you go see that dude. But there's no sergeant that's assigned the mission to make sure that you are prepared to exit the force, none. And that's not the government's responsibility. The people that are incentivized to help you do that is the private sector, because you're money to them. You're what they're looking for. I mean, every day they wake up, they're looking for talent, man. There is nobody in the world that's a CEO that doesn't focus 60% of his time on talent and chemistry. You know, it's just the way it is. You will not survive if you don't have talent. You can have the greatest idea in the world, but if you got a shitty team, guess what? You lose. And so people are really, really cognizant of talent and stuff. And so what we have done is we're spending a lot of energy on helping our community be able to get out there and find good, meaningful work, stuff that they want to do. And that's a big thing, you know, but it's up to the NCOs. I tell the NCOs, and I brief the Senior Enlisted Academy over here, you know, big deal all the time. This is on them. They're 85% of the force. When they start saying, hey, boys and girls, everybody pay attention. Here's what we're going to do. It's done. Done. It's over. I keep telling them, all the officers aren't going to say shit. They'll just say, yeah, good on your top, you know, kick ass. But it's up to them. And, you know, there's just a lot of things that we've got to do up front to help these people. You know, when you start talking to soldiers about financial preparedness, you can't do that when they're E8s and E9s. It's too late. It's too late.
Great stuff, man.
Yeah, we're just trying to help. I mean, you know, we're kind of getting into our stride. So this is the, you know, it's taking longer. We were born in sequestration. So this is what I tell people. We came out of the egg swinging. People were getting cut. It was a horrible year for the Defense Department, and we grew tremendously. But we've got, you know, phenomenal corporate partners. I mean, these are companies that want to be in the community. Most of them are former special ops people, and they want to be in the community. They want to hire our people. They want to be a part. They have the same culture, ethics, and ethos as the soft community. And so they, you know, they are us. Now, they deploy with us. About 30% of everybody out there on the battlefield, some sort of contractor support entity somehow. So 1/3 of the force is them. and they like hiring us. And they also provide great opportunities to our people outside of just some military contracting. We have a lot of our people. My Navy SEAL, Darren Evenson from SOC Gear, is the number three guy at Airbnb. He's worth a lot of money, but he's at Airbnb, man. He's out there renting apartments or whatever Airbnb does.
They're making a lot of money, I'll tell you that.
You're doing great, man. I mean, but, you know, he works his butt off, and he's one brilliant guy. He's too smart to be in the military, especially a SEAL, but he's a genius. I mean, he's no kidding, straight up genius. And I'm sure he's just killing it. You know, I know he is. And we have a lot of really smart, gifted people. Once we find what they're good at and what they really want to do, they do exceptionally well at it.
Well, all right. I want to thank you for all your time. Once again, thank you for your service and thank you for your friendship.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been a blast catching up. And now that we're almost neighbors, we're going to have to do this in person.
There you go. All right, brother. Thank you.
All right. So for myself, Steve Balistrieri here at Soft Rep Radio, Stu Braden, Global Soft Foundation, we want to thank you, everyone, for listening, and we'll be back soon with another podcast.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at Soft Rep Radio.